Okay, we'll get started now. So today, well, first of all, homework set six is supposedly to be done today. Of course, the due date on WebAssign is at the very end of the semester. The due dates that I post on Canvas are the dates you should try to get the homework done so that you stay concurrent with the class. Homework set six, that dealt with matrices and their subspaces, how to find bases for those. The calculations that are done on homework set six are going to be relevant this week, so I want you to try to get those done by tonight so that on Wednesday's lecture, Friday's lecture, you start associating subspaces to linear transformation, you'll know how to find their bases. So, I've also posted a new homework assignment seven, that's going to be due the Monday after spring break. So not next Monday, but the following Monday. And then the second exam is probably going to occur the week that you come back from spring break. I think we'll get through linear transformation this week. I would think that maybe Wednesday of, I think that's the 7th. So that would be Wednesday is the 23rd of March. That's a likely date for the second exam, but we'll actually schedule it maybe on Friday of this week when I have a better idea of how far we've gotten through linear transformation. So if we get through the material on linear transformation by Friday, then it makes sense to talk about the homework and do a review session on Monday and then have an exam on Wednesday. Could also have it on Friday, which would be the 25th of March. However, I've already got one request that someone's going to be out of town. Another one has an exam on that day. So I've had two requests not to have it on Friday, the 25th. So if we don't do it on the 23rd, then it possibly will get pushed forward to the week after the week you come back from the spring break. But if we do that, then I'm going to start talking about new material even before we have the exam on up to the new transformations. Okay, so that's where we are in the course. Today what I'm going to do is quickly review the notion of linear transformations. The main topic for today is to relate linear transformation to matrices. As is, we've done so often in this course, I'll introduce an abstract concept like a base or subspace, and then I'll try to give you a calculational platform where you can actually compute things, and that will typically involve a matrix. You'll see the same theme today. And in fact, there'll be two subspaces that we can attach to a linear transformation. The way we actually display them explicitly is by looking at the corresponding matrices, a matrix that would correspond to a linear transformation. So let me put some formal ideas up that we've been dealing with. Since we came back from the first exam, in mathematics, formal mathematics actually starts with two really basic objects, sets and functions. So when we like we came back from the first exam, our topic principally was this special case of the idea of a set of objects. And that were the so-called subspaces of the vector space Rm. Now what these were there special subsets, say S, every point, every element of S is also an element of Rn. That's just saying it's a subspace, but what we required in addition we demand, since we're in linear algebra, compatibility of this notion with respect to scalar multiplication and vector addition. So we would demand that if you start off with a number and you start off with a vector that lives inside this set S, then necessarily the scalar multiple of your vector by the number stays inside that set. And second of all, if you have two vectors, say B and W, that start off living inside your subset, that after you add them together, you're still inside that subspace. Well, that's special sets that are relevant to linear algebra. Similarly, as we discovered last time, for linear algebra, we have a special case for functions. Since we deal in linear algebra constantly with vector spaces, we focus on functions between vector spaces, the Rn, Rn. And we're not interested in so much in every possible function between two vector spaces, but rather ones that behave well with respect to our special vector operations. So, such that this function has the property that if I have a number and I have a vector that lives inside the domain, so a vector inside Rn, same vector space as where the function begins, then the compatibility requirement is that T applied to a scalar multiple of B has to be the same thing as that scalar multiplication applied to the image of B. So what this is saying is I can do the scalar multiplication before or after I apply the linear transformation, but I get the same result. Well, that's not going to happen for every function, but it must be the case for a linear transformation. And second of all, if we start off with two vectors, say B1 and B2, that start off living inside your domain, then what we require is that when we add them together, we get the same result as if we delayed that addition until after we applied the linear transformation. Okay, so the way to think about this is that the mathematically we're interested in sets, and then later, more advanced mathematics, functions between sets that will allow us to relate different sets. What we require in linear algebra is even more. We want these sets and functions to behave well with respect to our fundamental vector space operation. Constant theme in this course. And so what I did last time is I introduced linear transformation, and that's exactly functions like this. Functions between two vector space that are compatible with scalar multiplication and vector addition. We'll relate them to matrices, and then we'll start to talk about subspaces associated with these functions. Okay, so I'm just putting up the definition again of a linear transformation. Compatible behavior with a new fundamental vector space operation. That's the substance of the definition. And I showed you last time, there's one way of making such a function is to use a matrix. And what we actually use to define a function that maps one vector space to another is matrix multiplication. The way that will work is that we start off with a list of m numbers, and we think of that as a column vector. If we think of x as a column vector, then it can be multiplied by a matrix. And in fact, the dimensions are going to all work out as soon as we write them down. You start off with an m by n matrix, and you set x equal to m by 1 column vector, then a times x, well, what's this going to be? It's an n by m matrix multiplying an m by 1 column vector. That's going to produce, we got the match of the inner dimensions, which is necessary for this matrix multiplication to be defined. The result then is going to be an n by 1 column vector, which you can think of as an n-dimensional vector, because in this column, there's going to be exactly n entries. All right, and then, so what does this matrix multiplication do?
It takes an n-dimensional vector and it produces an n-dimensional vector. So what is the function between these two vector spaces? And moreover, these two properties are going to follow naturally. Let me show you that real quickly. If T subscript A, I'm going to, so I'll fix A. Fix A an M by M matrix. Then I have a function from Rm to Rn defined by T subscript A of x is equal to A times x, where I interpret this as a column vector that can be multiplied by this matrix and will produce an n-dimensional vector. So now, right, so this shows you anytime I have a matrix, I can create a linear transformation. What I'm main point of today's lecture is that the opposite is also true. Given a linear transformation, say T, and we'll just we think of this as a general linear transformation between two vector spaces, then there'll be an associated matrix, which in some ways is kind of like the utility of the theorem about the state is kind of like the way we use elementary matrices. When we use elementary matrices because we wanted a way of implementing elementary row operations, but doing it via matrix multiplication. That's actually the goal of today's lecture, is to, given a function between two vector space, associate to that a matrix that will do the same thing. And then all our calculations can be done on that concrete numerical object, the matrix, rather than this more abstract function. So that's the goal today. Not only given a matrix can we create a linear transformation, but given a linear transformation, we can create a corresponding matrix. Well, here's the statement. Every linear transformation, there's going to be a unique matrix that the action of acting, whatever this function does to an element of Rm, that can be replicated by doing matrix multiplication for a particular matrix. And I'll give you an explicit formula for that matrix in just a couple minutes. But what I'm going to do to describe how we get this matrix, I'm going to look at a little more closely at this matrix multiplication first. So let's take an M by N matrix and a column vector, and I'm going to write, this elaborate notation, column subscript J, that's to represent the jth column of A. More explicitly, if we have A equaling A11, A12, ... A1m, then similar rows until we get the nth row, AN2, AM. What I mean by column J of A is the column vector I create by grabbing the jth column of this. So somewhere in here is the jth column. The row indices are going to go from 1 to n, but we're fixed the column index constantly j. All right, so that's, you just look at the matrix and you grab the corresponding column. All right, so what does that do for us? Well, my claim is that when I multiply an arbitrary vector x times the matrix A, that the result of this multiplication can be interpreted as a linear combination of the columns of the matrix A. And in fact, well, this is a linear combination, right? Bunch of numbers times vectors summed up. And the claim is that B
to compute this matrix product, an alternative way would be to take the entries in this vector and use those as coefficients of this linear combination, where the corresponding vectors are the columns of the matrix A. It doesn't take much to prove this. All we have to do is compute this product. Here it is. How do we do this? We take the dot product of each row with the first vector with the one and only column of the second vector. That produces this n-dimensional vector, because each row here is going to take a dot product, is going to produce a number that will put in one of the plots of the n-dimensional result. And then what I could do, we're familiar with this operation, next operation, is basically we have a bunch of vectors that are being added together, and some of them are being multiplied by these parameters x1, x2, and k. So I simply take this n-dimensional vector, and I'll expand it with respect to these parameters x1, x2, up to xn. So this first set of terms, that's just x1 times the first column of A. The second set of terms have a common factor x2, and they're multiplying the second column of that matrix. So in fact, we're getting exactly that expansion. Anytime you multiply a column vector by a matrix, it's equivalent to constructing a linear combination of the columns of A, where the coefficients are exactly the entries of the vector x. All right, well, that's first half of what I'm going to tell you. The second half is even easier, should be familiar. There's a notion of a standard basis for Rn. The first basis vector is where we have 1 in the first slot and 0 everywhere else. Second standard basis vector is where in the second slot we have 1, 0 everywhere else. And we just get a bunch of vectors simply by putting 1 in one of the components of an n-dimensional vector. All right, so what's special about this? Well, we get a list of vectors, and in fact, they generate the entire space, right? Because one way to see that is x1 times first, let's write x1 e1 plus x2 e2 plus xm em. If I write this out, I have x1 times 1, 0, 0 plus x2 times 0, 1, 0, etc. plus xm dot 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 xm times 0, 0, 0, 1. When I take this linear combination and I add them all up, well, the x1 only contributes to the first component, the x2 only contributes to the second component as well. So this is just x1 xm. So this ordered list of m numbers can be expanded in terms of these standard basis vectors. All right, so that's of course sort of standard. Physicists use this construction all the time, except they tend to call these standard basis vectors I, J, and K for a three-dimensional space. While we're considering more general spaces, so all use subscripts rather than different Latin letters to indicate the standard basis vector. But the same idea. All right. So one thing is that every vector inside our vector space can be written as a linear combination of these guys. But it's also pretty clear that these guys are linearly independent, because the only way a linear combination of the standard basis vectors can produce the zero vector is, well, look what got to happen here. If you set zero equal to this linear combination, well, this linear combination is equivalent to this vector. And this vector is not going to equal the zero vector unless all the components are equal to zero. But then, if you have a set of vectors such that the only linear combination that produces a zero vector is the one where all the coefficients are separately equal to zero, that's the definition of linear independence. So because these vectors only sum a linear combination of them only sums to zero when all the coefficients equal zero. That makes them linearly independent. And now, recalling some definitions from last week, we have a set of generators, enough of them to create the whole vector space, and they're linearly independent. Then there are what we call the bases. The role of bases, as I originally introduced, is that bases provide coordinates. Now, this was done in the context of subspaces. If B is equal to, say, B1 to BK, if that's a basis for a subspace, say, let's call it S, then what we can do is we can coordinateize all the vectors that live inside this subspace using this basis. The idea is that, well, these generate the entire subspace, and so every W sitting inside this subspace can be written, actually uniquely written, as a linear combination of these vectors. So W is going to equal C1, B1, plus dot, 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 CK, BK. When I introduced bases, I talked a lot about coordinization. The purpose of the basis was to provide coordinates for vectors that live inside your subspace. The idea was that you would use these expansion coefficients as coordinates. So C1 to CK are the coordinates of the given vector inside our given subspace. All right, so these are also a basis, but they're not so much a subspace of Rm. They actually generate Rm itself. But a vector space is always a subspace of itself. But you can think of this example as being a special case of this construction. What's really special about these standard basis vectors is that for a general subspace, you have a basis, then you get a set of coordinates for each vector that lives inside that basis. When your subspace is the entire vector space and your basis is the standard basis vectors, what turns out is your coordinate vector is the same as the vector you started off with. Why is that? Well, you can, I don't have it written down anymore, but here it is. If I say I have a vector W, and I represent it as a linear combination of my standard basis vectors. Well, when I grab the coefficients in this expansion and write down, use them as a list to form a vector, I get exactly the same vector I started off with. This would be, this vector was x1 to xm. I expand it, grab the coefficients to produce a coordinate vector, but it's the same vector I started off with. All right, so I never talked that much about standard basis vectors, even when I introduced vectors, mostly because I didn't want to confuse you. The coordinate vector is the same as the vector, but that's only true for the standard basis. All right, but we'll use that fact now. So here I'm just saying that once you expand any vector in terms of the standard basis, the coordinate vector you get is exactly the vector you started off with. So I'm using this subscript here because, in general, the coordinates, if I'm thinking about an arbitrary subspace, I have many bases for this, and so my coordinate system is actually going to depend on my choice of bases. What I'm saying here is that when I use the standard basis, my coordinate vector that I get by expanding in terms of my basis vectors and then grabbing the coefficient, that coincides with the original vector for the standard basis. All right, so I've got two ideas.
presented that I need to prove the theorem that says that given a linear transformation, there's an associated matrix that actually replicates the action. So that instead of having to think of T as a function that we apply to the components of X, rather we can think of it as being simply matrix multiplication of the column vector that corresponds to that vector. All right, and in fact, this formula here tells you exactly how we're going to construct this matrix. What we do is, so T gets applied to n-dimensional vectors, and the result after we apply the function is an n-dimensional vector. So, for each, this is an n-dimensional space, so there'll be n standard basis vectors for this vector space Rn. I apply the function T to that. That's going to be valid because each of these standard basis vectors is an element of this vector space. So I can compute these numbers. Then what this is saying is that I compute these numbers, I get a list of n numbers, and I write that as a column. So what I get is m columns in each column, and I write this result, and I write it vertically, there's going to be n entries, so these columns are going to have n rows. So this linear transformation that goes from an n-dimensional vector space to an n-dimensional vector space, to that, I can attach a matrix with m columns and n rows, or equivalently, an m by m matrix. My claim is that when I construct this matrix in this fashion, then the original transformation, its action can be replicated by matrix multiplication by this matrix. Now, this is not necessarily giving you a simpler way to figure out what P of X is. The reason why we use it is that working with matrices is much closer to the calculational setting. Once you have a concrete matrix, you just have a list of numbers arranged in a rectangular array, and that's because you're dealing with numbers, they're naturally computable. All right, so let's prove this. It's really simple. Suppose we have this matrix, and I construct it in exactly this fashion. I want to show that the original function, its action can be replicated by matrix multiplication. So T applied to X, well, I'm going to write that as T applied to, well, I have a vector inside Rn, I can expand it with respect to the standard basis. So I'm just replacing X by expansion with respect to the standard basis. And then what I can do is use properties of T. T is a linear transformation. So that means I can delay vector addition until after I apply the transformation, and the result will be the same. So that T preserved vector addition. But now when I look at where T is acting, it's acting on scalar multiples of vectors. A linear transformation also preserves scalar multiplication. So I can pull these factors to X1 through the action of T. I can throw Xm through the action of T. And so this line is equivalent to this because T preserves scalar multiplication. Now, the next step is to recognize that T of E1 is the first column of this matrix. T of E2 would be the second term in this expansion. And so I write that out. And then the last step relies on that matrix identity. That matrix multiplication can be implemented by taking the components of the vector you're multiplying by and multiplying it by a particular column of your matrix. So this is the definition, going from here to here is the definition of how we got the columns of A. And then this last identity is our matrix multiplication identity. Anytime you multiply a column vector by a matrix, that's equivalent to taking a linear combination of the columns of the matrix and multiplying it by the components of the vector. All right, and so there it is. T applied to an arbitrary vector X is going to be exactly the same thing as matrix multiplication by this matrix on X. Okay, so let's do an explicit example. So I'll give you a particular function between two vector spaces. And I'll show you, first of all, that it's a linear transformation. And then I'll show you that we'll explicitly construct the matrix that corresponds to that function. Right, here's the function. It takes an input of three numbers, and its output is two numbers. So it's going from R3 to R2. So it's got a linear transformation because, well, what we'll do is we want to verify that T of a scalar multiple of X is the same thing as that scalar multiple times T of X. Let's verify that. So what I'll do is I'll substitute for X its expression in terms of components. I'll do the scalar multiplication completely before I apply the linear transformation. But now I'll apply this rule. For X1, I'll use this formula, but I'll substitute lambda X1 for X1, lambda X2 for X2, lambda X3 for X3, and compute. Well, this first component here is the difference of the first two components of the argument. So we have lambda X1 minus lambda X2. And the second component, the sum of the last two components. So I sum these two guys, I get the second component. Every component has a common factor of lambda. I just pull that out. And then I notice that this particular vector is exactly the image of x1, x2, x3 by this function. And so now I verify that T of a scalar multiple of x is the same thing as that scalar multiple times T of x. And we've shown that this function is compatible with scalar multiplication. If this had been, these had been nonlinear functions of the variables x1 and x2, this would not hold. In fact, if these had been linear functions with a constant term, this would not hold. But because these are linear functions without constant term, this is actually guaranteed. All right, so it behaves properly with respect to scalar addition. Next, we look at vector addition. Oops, sorry, backwards. Here I'll apply the function, find above, I'll apply that to a sum of two vectors, x and y. I'll write the components of x and y. I add them together. Now I'll apply t to this three-dimensional vector with components x1 plus y1, x2, y2, etc. The rule is specified above. The first component is the difference of the first two components, so we'll have x1 plus y1 minus x2 plus y2 for that first component. And this formula here also tells you how to compute the second component. All we have to do is collect together the x, the terms involving x and the terms involving y within each component. And then we can break this sum apart into the sum of two-dimensional vectors. The first one can be identified as t of x. Just t of x, and the second one is t of y. And so we've got the desired identity. That t applied to an arbitrary sum of vectors inside R3 is always going to end up being the same thing as the sum of t of x plus the sum of t of y. So we're compatible with respect to vector addition. Showing that compatibility with respect to scalar multiplication and vector addition makes this a linear transformation. All right, so all I've done so far, and you're not going to have to do this in general. In general, I'll tell you you have a linear transformation. You can assume these properties hold. But this first example, I wanted to show you how you verify that that something is a linear transformation. You just check these rules by calculating. All right, then now what we'll do is we'll take this function that we've now proved to be a linear transformation, we'll construct a corresponding matrix. So that means we look at the action of T on each of the standard basis vectors with a domain R3. Well, what does it do to the first standard basis vector? It sends 1, 0, 0 to the point 1, 0, just by applying to this rule. It sends the second standard basis vector to minus 1, 1. And it sends the third standard basis vector
to the vector 0, 1.
All right, now, warning. Take this emphatically now, because this is the most common mistake on the second exam. It looks like we're pretty close to a matrix here, but in fact, AT is not going to equal, what have I got? 1, 0, minus 1, 1, 0, 1. That is not the right matrix. And I can show you why it can't be that matrix. Suppose we were looking for a matrix, AT, such that when I do matrix multiplication of a vector inside the domain, we get the same thing as applying the function directly. Now, what if I had used this matrix, let me call this tilde. And, this is not it. Let's call this some other spurious name, BT, some other matrix. What I'll show you is that this matrix cannot possibly satisfy this identity, because T is taking three-dimensional vectors to two-dimensional vectors. If I write down this matrix, 1, 0, minus 1, 1, and 0, 1, and I try to multiply a three-dimensional vector by it, well, it's not defined. Because this is a matrix with three rows, two columns, and we're trying to multiply a matrix with three rows and one column, but these inner dimensions don't match, so the matrix multiplication is not going to work. So, although this is the first thing you'll write down as you try to compute this matrix, remember that this matrix that you get by just sort of taking this rectangular arrangement of numbers, that's the wrong matrix. What you have to do is take these guys, convert them to columns before you write the matrix. You step back to the matrix we're trying to construct. Several slides back, I guess. This is how we're going to construct the matrix. We're going to compute these guys, but we're not going to write them as row vectors. We're going to write them as column vectors. And what would happen here is that would make this, the right matrix is actually going to be AT is equal to 1, 0, minus 1, 1, and 0, 1, because this is, in fact, the matrix I get by applying T to 1, 0, 0, and T applied to 0, 1, 0, and T applied to 0, 0, 1, and writing the results vertically. Okay? And so, move ahead to where we're actually working with that matrix here. So here it is, previous slide. So when I take the results of applying T to each of the standard basis vectors, and I write the results vertically rather than horizontally, then I get the right matrix. Remember the form of this matrix? This is it, same matrix I had before, but now when I do matrix multiplication of an arbitrary three-dimensional vector by the matrix correctly constructed, it produces this result. And now notice that the first component is x1 minus x2. It agrees with the first component of T applied to an arbitrary vector. And the second component, x2 plus x3, it agrees with the second component of the original function. So this is all working. But it won't work, I stress again, it won't work unless you remember to convert the results of applying T to the standard basis vectors. You have to remember to convert those to columns. All right. So, we have about 8 minutes left. What we have so far is a way not only to take a matrix and produce a linear transformation, but now we have a way of taking a linear transformation and attaching to the linear transformation to a matrix. So in fact, what we have is a way of going from linear transformations from m-dimensional space to an n-dimensional space, we can go back and forth between these guys and n by m matrices. So, so for example, if we have a linear transformation, T from Rm to Rn, then we can produce a matrix, A subscript T, by applying the linear transformation to every standard basis vector and writing them as columns. Em written as a column. Or if we have a matrix, from that we can produce a linear transformation by saying that T subscript A of X is the vector we obtain by multiplying, interpreting X as a column vector and then multiplying it by A. So from a linear transformation, we can get a matrix, and from a matrix, we can get a linear transformation. And of course, whether we start here or we start here, they just replicate itself. So if you went from a linear transformation to a matrix, and then you went from that matrix back to the linear transformation, you get right back where you started from. So they really are equivalent. And we will use that. All right. So suffice to say that there's a very, in fact, in some sense, an exact metaphor between linear transformations and matrices. And what we're going to now do is, because we have subspaces associated with matrices, we should expect, given this close relationship between these functions and these matrices, that we should have subspaces also associated with linear transformation. However, I'm not going to use the matrix formulation of a linear transformation to define that subspace. Rather, I'm going to give you a functional interpretation of what that subspace is, and then we'll resort to matrices when we want to actually compute it. All right, so here we go. I'll just probably just be able to manage to tell you what the range of a linear transformation is today, and then we'll pick up with the rest of the story on Wednesday. So I'm going to start with some linear transformation between an m-dimensional vector space and an m-dimensional vector space. To this is going to be some matrix, and of course with a matrix we can always create a subspace by looking at the row space, or the column space, or the null space of the matrix. Well, what I'm going to do next is tell you how to find effectively the column space of a matrix that corresponds to a given linear transformation. But I'm not going to define it through its associated matrix. I'm going to define that subspace from a certain function property. So let me draw a picture. So this is general function theory. If you have a function that maps a set A to another set B, there's a special subset of B that you can create by looking at all the points of B that somehow are reachable by this function. We call that the image. The image of F is the points or the elements B inside the set capital B, such that B is equal to F of A for some A inside the domain. All right, so to set this set up, all I need is a function between two sets. Then I'm just focusing on where do the elements of A land when they're mapped over to B. And that's exactly what this image set is. What I'm going to describe is the specialization of this construction to when the function is actually between two vector spaces and the function itself is a linear transformation. So when F corresponds to a linear transformation, the image of F is called the range of T. So more specifically, the range of a linear transformation, this linear transformation from an n-dimensional space to an n-dimensional space, that's exactly the points y in the target space, which is going to be Rn, that are reachable by applying this function to some element in the domain Rn. Y is equal to T of x or some x inside the domain Rn. All right, so that's construction of this set. It's just using general function mechanism. But what I'll show you is that, in fact, this range, this set of every element in the range is also an element of vector space Rn. What I'll show you is that this is actually a subspace. I created a set, but now I must show that it's closed under scalar multiplication and vector addition. Well, here we go. First thing we have to do is show that it's closed under scalar multiplication. So let's start with a point that lives inside the image of a linear transformation and choose a number. And I want to show that scalar multiplication of this guy by lambda is still inside this set. All right, so let's start. I want to show that this, as long as y is in the range, then a scalar multiple of y is also inside the range. So I need to display lambda times y as resulting from applying t to some point in the domain. Well, here we go. T of lambda x, I'll just choose this point. It's the same thing as lambda times t of x, because a linear transformation is compatible with scalar multiplication. But t of lambda x is y is equal to t of x, just lambda times y. So what does this show you? It shows you that this number, or this vector lambda times y, is obtainable by applying t to this particular vector. Okay, good. So that shows you that lambda times y is an element of the range, because it occurs by applying t to a vector in the domain. And similarly, it's closed under vector addition, because if I start off with two points that live inside the range, then they have to come from two different vectors inside, two vectors inside the domain. So if these guys live in the range, they have to come from the domain. So I'll write them as y1 is t applied to this guy, and y2 is t applied to this guy. But now, this sum of vectors, it corresponds to applying t to a sum of vectors here. The sum of vectors is still going to live inside the domain. And so t applied to a sum of vectors is equal to this particular vector, and that's displaying the sum of two elements are in the range is realizable by applying t to another particular vector inside the domain, which shows you that, in fact, every point, if you take any two vectors inside the range, then necessarily they have to come from some point in the, that vector sum had to come from some point in the domain. And so you start off in the range and you add vectors together, you're still in the range. And so effectively I've shown in the two slides that the range of T defined in this fashion is closed under scalar multiplication and vector addition. And so it's a subspace. All right, so I'm out of time. So what I'll show you on Wednesday, now that we've established a subspace, how do we find a basis for that subspace? And it's going to turn out that this subspace is actually identical to the column space of the associated matrix. You know, homework set 6, you've spent a lot of time finding bases for column spaces of matrices. That's what we'll apply here to get the basis for the range. Okay, so I'll stop here, and we'll pick up with this on Wednesday.